Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In his book, Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland, Ed McClelland chronicles the rise, fall, and hopeful revitalization of some of America's boomtowns. A Michigan native and no stranger to smoky industrial centers, Ed McClelland wonders what's next for these cities and how they might be revived. On his recent trip to Pittsburgh, McClelland met with Essential Pittsburgh producer Marcus Charleston, who began by asking about his motivations for writing the book.
Well, a couple of reasons. I think what really inspired me, first of all, was I went to high school in Lansing, Michigan, across the street from a Fisher Body plant. And it used to be that sort of the school and the plant were sort of it was an integrated process. They trained the workers at the school, and then they went across the street to work in the plant. You'd have a diploma in your hand one day, and then you'd have a ratchet in your hand 2 weeks later. And I started high school in 1982, which was really the beginning of the terrible recession here in the Midwest. And we had a science teacher who said, well, it used to be that you could just didn't have to study, and you could just walk across the street and get a job in that plant. But things have changed. You guys are going to have to study hard and go to college. And it was torn down in 2006, and it was actually replaced by another plant across town. But I didn't know that at the time, that was coming. So I just kind of wanted to look at, you know, what happened to all these factories and what happened to this great era of employment that we'd had here in the Midwest, when you could literally, if you lost a job in the morning, walk across town and get a job in another factory in the afternoon. So it was kind of a generational thing for me, being Generation X and coming of age in the early 90s when it wasn't so easy to get a job. And hearing these stories from GM veterans, for me it was just kind of like employment porn.
Why did you title the book Nothing But Blue Skies? It's a very optimistic title for a kind of a depressing topic.
Well, it's sort of ironic because, and I'm sure people in Pittsburgh can relate to this, that I talked to a guy in South Chicago who'd grown up next to the U.S. steel plant, and they had a saying back then, the skies were so befouled that, you know, women would do their laundry. They'd hang their laundry inside because they didn't want them to get covered with soot, and people would drive old cars to work. And they had a saying, if there's soot on the windows, there's food on the table. And after U.S. Steel closed down, this gentleman said to me, I looked up and saw a blue sky, and I thought it was the end of the world. But I also wanted to give the sense that, well, this is a chance this is a clean slate. This is a chance to invent a new kind of city and find a new post-industrial future.
Do we know where the term Rust Belt came from?
I do know where the term Rust Belt came from. Well, originally it was Rust Bowl, and this was sort of it was meant to evoke the Dust Bowl, which was another economic crisis back in the 1930s. And the first use I found of it was in a Time magazine article in 1981, but Walter Mondale also used it during his presidential campaign. He was giving a speech outside a steel mill in Cleveland, and he accused President Reagan of turning the Midwest into a rust bowl. And then it was just sort of changed in the fashion of journalese to match the Sun Belt to sort of be the competing or balancing part of the country.
Pittsburgh is often held up as the poster city for Rust Belt revitalization, while Detroit is viewed as the example of urban decline.
Mm-hmm.
Are these reputations deserved?
Well, I would say in Detroit, definitely so. I remember I was in Detroit a couple years ago during Movement, the electronic music festival, and there were a lot of Europeans there, and they all wanted to go, and they wanted to look at the Michigan Central train station and the old Packard plant. And I think one reason that Europeans are so fascinated by Detroit is that that couldn't happen in their countries. A city would not be allowed to fail like that. They're either propped up through government intervention, or they build green belts around them to prevent urban sprawl. So I mean, Detroit is the only city to go over a million and then drop down under a million in American history. And if you took the entire population loss of Detroit, it would constitute the 10th largest city in the United States. So they're down to about 700,000 now.
It's amazing in reading your book that so many of these cities, like Cleveland and Detroit, at one time were in the top 10 of cities in America.
Oh, yeah. Cleveland was seventh. Detroit was – I think Detroit was fourth or fifth. And now it's 17th or 18th.
It's Essential Pittsburgh, and we're talking with author Edward Ted McClelland about the book Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. I'd like to do a lightning round.
Okay.
I'll say a city, and in a line or two, you tell me the industry that made the city great and what led to the city's downfall.
Okay.
Detroit.
Well, the auto industry made the city great, and what led to the city's downfall, I can tell you a couple things. One is that the auto plants moved out because they had these multi-level auto plants, and they wanted single-level auto plants, and there wasn't enough room in Detroit. Ironically, there's plenty of room now. The 1967 riot, and also the drug trade of the 1970s.
Cleveland,
that would probably be the steel industry. And in the 1970s, after a lot of pollution controls were passed, partly as a result of the Cuyahoga River catching fire, some of these steel mills just moved out of town or moved to China.
Buffalo.
Buffalo, the shipping industry. Buffalo was the link between the Atlantic Ocean through the Erie Canal and the Great Lakes. And all the ships would come and drop the grain off there, and they can buy barge to New York City. And once the St. Lawrence Seaway was built in 1957, Buffalo was bypassed.
Well, you concentrate on the cities surrounding the Great Lakes. Can't the term Rust Belt also be applied to more inland cities like Syracuse and Allentown?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, well, and Pittsburgh. Syracuse was an interesting story. I sort of use Syracuse for a larger discussion of air conditioning and the effect that how air conditioning reordered American demography. The air conditioner was invented in Buffalo, and Syracuse was the headquarters of the Carrier Corporation, which is the largest manufacturers of air conditioning. And, of course, air conditioning made the Sun Belt possible. My grandmother was born in Florida in 1924, and at the time, I think it was one of the most sparsely populated states in the country. And then air conditioning came along and it boomed, and so did Texas. I mean, you can't imagine living in Houston without air conditioning. And as a result, Carrier moved its operations down south to be closer to its market, and also because there were cheaper non-union workers in that part of the country. So Syracuse really invented the appliance that caused its own demise.
Since you live in Chicago now, what's it like for you to go home to Michigan?
What's it like for me to go? Well, my hometown is not hasn't suffered as much as other places because it had a sort of a more diversified economy. With it's the state capital and also has university. But to go to places like Flint, which has the highest murder rate in the country, or to Detroit, where parts of the city just look like rural poverty. It's distressing, and it's distressing to think of my home state as, you know, an international symbol of urban decay, and also just to see the inability of Detroit and the rest of the state to work together.
What would it take to bring that back?
Well, we're never going to have what we had in the 50s and 60s. That was just a unique moment in world history when we were the only country in the world that had any industrial capacity left after World War II. The rest of the world was really flat on its back. We didn't import anything. We built everything for the whole world and exported everything. But I think at least Michigan, I wish they would recognize the fact that, you know, you've got Detroit and Flint, which are being overseen by emergency managers. And I think they need to recognize the fact that those cities just can't support themselves anymore, that they have to be merged with the surrounding suburbs like they did in Indianapolis or Toronto and Miami. We just can't afford all those governments anymore.
How do the people in the cities that you visited feel about their cities? Are they optimistic about the future? Are they living in the past?
Well, Cleveland's never optimistic. that's just the Cleveland psyche. Clevelanders worry more about what the rest of the country thinks about Cleveland than the rest of the country spends thinking about Cleveland. So, yeah, Cleveland's not terribly optimistic. Detroit, I think a lot of people in Detroit feel like, you know, they have a chance to do something new and something unique. I mean, I met and they have this feeling that the eyes of the world are on them. I met a couple people involved in urban farming in Detroit, and they had gotten, I mean, Detroit's gotten so much media attention, and I think they were very conscious of the fact that, you know, they were filmmakers were visiting them, and journalists like myself were visiting them, and that people really wanted to see Detroit succeed.
So you've seen some ray of hope in the blue skies.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, we can talk about Homestead if you want.
Definitely. Okay. You do devote a chapter in the book to Homestead. Tell us the story.
Okay. Well, I kind of felt, and I'm certainly not the first one to notice this, because there was a great book called Homestead, The Glory and Tragedy of an American Steel Town by William Sarin. And his story, he wrote that about 20 years ago, after the steel mills had closed and after the town had really gone bankrupt and had become a ward of the state of Pennsylvania. And I guess I picked it up 20 years later, but I went all the way back 100 years to the 1890s. And what I found was that no city in America, no place in America has more history per square mile than Homestead. I mean, Homestead is one square mile, but it was the site of the famous 1892 Homestead strike when the Pinkertons and the steelworkers shot it out. And it's where Mother Jones came to organize the steelworkers and where the Homestead Grays got started, you know, with African Americans who were brought up from the South as strike breakers to begin with. There was also a lot of labor strife there in the 1980s, as U.S. Steel just gradually began to shut it down. The union was extremely militant. They would do things like when Mellon Bank foreclosed on Mesta Machinery, people would go in and they would put fish in safe deposit boxes and stink up the whole bank.
Oh, man.
And in one instance, some steel workers invaded a Christmas party at Shadyside Presbyterian Church because that was where so many of the executives worshipped, and they threw balloons filled with skunk oil and terrified the children there. But by around 1990, Homestead was broke, and I talked to a professor, architecture professor at Carnegie Mellon named David Lewis, and he looked at a map of the Pittsburgh area, and he noticed that as a result of the urban sprawl, Homestead was right smack dab in the middle. And he came up with the idea of, after the plant was torn down, building a mall there, which became the Waterfront Mall. And the Homestead Works, I mean, this was the largest steel mill in the world. This was the steel mill that provided the steel for the Brooklyn Bridge and the U.S. Navy and the Apollo program. And it was just all razed to scrap. But they put the mall there, and it was the first site like that to be remediated in the whole state of Pennsylvania. So there was a lot of public investment involved, and you know they built the mall there, and as I'm sure people know, they left the smokestacks there as a reminder of what it was. But it did rescue the town's finances, the tax revenue did, but it's also sort of a commentary on what America has become, going from a nation that makes things to a nation of shopkeepers.
Well, it's interesting, as you point out in that chapter, one generation knows that as the area of a steel mill.
Right.
And another generation knows it as simply a shopping destination.
Exactly. And there's a quote in there from a gentleman named Mike Stout, who worked in the mill and was one of the last to leave because he talked about that. And he talked about how young people have no idea of what the employment situation was like for their fathers and their grandfathers. And he also says, you know, we can't just base an economy on selling each other things. We can't all take in each other's laundry. You can't really have a middle class without manufacturing. And certainly the people who are working at the AMC Theater or the Dave and Buster's aren't pulling down the middle class incomes that people did in the Homestead Works.
Well, for the young people and not so young people out there who want to know about the history, the book is Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland by Edward Ted McClelland. Thank you for joining us in Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me here.
Coming up, Speaking Volumes and business correspondent Rebecca Harris on what's luring people back to the Berg. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.